Okay, welcome. My name is Brendan Wolf. I am managing editor of Encyclopedia Virginia, a program of the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. You can find us at encyclopediavirginia.org. And when we're done here today and you're looking for a refresher on Buck v. Bell, you can find my entry on the subject at EV. So on behalf of the Encyclopedia, which is hosting this event, and the event's sponsor, LexisNexis, thank you for coming. Thank you also to the city of Charlottesville for being a sponsor of the Virginia Festival of the Book and for providing our venue. This event is right now being recorded for broadcast on Charlottesville's own TV 10 and will be available online at www.charlottesville.org/TV10. So later on, when we take questions from the audience, go ahead and raise your hand and wait for a mic to come so that we'll be able to hear you on the broadcast. Before we start, if you could silence your cell phones, that would be great. And if on your silent cell phone you are going to be tweeting about this event, you can use the hashtag VABook2016. A few notes about the festival before we get started. The Virginia Festival of the Book is free of charge, but it's not free of cost. Remember to go online and give back or pick up a giving envelope from the information desk at the Omni and support your festival so we may sustain it for many more years. I can tell you that my office is down the hall from the folks at the Festival of the Book, and you may not know this going from one event to another this week, but there is one full-time person running this festival. A couple people who are not full-time, and then a whole army of volunteers. It's really amazing what they do, and I hope we all can say thank you to them by giving back a little bit. Before you leave, please fill out evaluations. These provide useful information that helps keep the festival free and open to the public. You can fill out a paper evaluation before you leave or complete it online at vabook.org/survey. Finally, book sales. You'll notice Adam Cohen's book is for sale at the front of the room. So we will try to keep this program going until maybe about 5 o'clock, which will give us a half an hour for Adam to sign your books. So, this is Imbeciles, the Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. And we are thrilled to have author Adam Cohen here, whose book is that by that same name. Adam is the author of Imbeciles, the Supreme Court, American Eugenics, and the Sterilization of Carrie Buck. He's a journalist and lawyer who has served on the New York Times editorial board and as a senior writer at Time magazine, and he is also co-editor of the NationalBookReview.com. So, Adam.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here. First of all, it's a pleasure to be back in Charlottesville for a couple of reasons. One is, in many ways, this is really your story, right? Carrie Buck is a person who grew up on the streets here, who lived as much of her life here as she could, her early life, until she was taken away and institutionalized. And other characters in the book come right from here, Aubrey Strode, who represented Amherst County. So this really is a very local story. It's also a pleasure to be back because I did a lot of the research here, and everyone treated me wonderfully as I went through 158 boxes of Aubrey Strode papers, among other things. And it's also a pleasure to be here at the book festival. You know, I'm a big believer in book festivals. It's important, you know, in the 21st century, there's a battle for mind share, as they say, and we want to make sure that books, you know, have their place as they compete with everything else. And book festivals are a really important part of that in publicizing books and in connecting authors with readers. So I'm very grateful for this event. So let me begin. In 1927, the Supreme Court was asked to decide a simple question. Should Virginia be allowed to sterilize Carrie Buck, a 20-year-old inmate of the state colony for epileptics and feeble-minded, who had falsely been declared to be feeble-minded? In an 8-1 decision written by Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes, the court ruled that no part of the Constitution, not equal protection, not due process, not the right to bodily integrity, protected Carrie Buck from being sterilized against her will. Plenty terrible, but the court did even more. It also strongly endorsed the eugenics movement and issued a clarion call to the nation to sterilize more unfit people. Justice Holmes wrote that the nation had to sterilize those who, quote, sap the strength of the state to prevent our being swamped with incompetence. In words that could have been torn from the pages of a eugenics pamphlet, Holmes declared, "It is better for all the world if, instead of waiting to execute degenerate offspring for crime or to let them starve for their imbecility, society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind." Then Holmes went on to include in the decision one of the most brutal aphorisms in American jurisprudence. Holmes, the Harvard-educated scion of several of Boston's finest families, said of Carrie Buck, her mother, and her young daughter, "Three generations of imbeciles are enough." When legal scholars rank the Supreme Court's worst decisions, the competition is considerable. There was the Dred Scott case. There's a lot. There's Dred Scott, in which the court ruled that an enslaved man had no right to sue in court for his freedom. There was Plessy versus Ferguson, in which the court upheld Louisiana's law segregating railroad cars by race. And there was Korematsu versus the United States, in which the court upheld the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II. There will always be a difference of opinion over which ruling should be on the list of the worst decisions and how they should be ranked, but there can be no doubt that Buck v. Bell must have a prominent place. In its aftermath, not only was Carrie Buck sterilized against her will, but in the end, as many as 70,000 Americans were sterilized during this era. Many of the victims were, like Carrie, perfectly normal, both mentally and physically, and they desperately wanted to have children. Buck v. Bell's reach extended beyond the United States. The Nazi Party, which was on the rise in Germany, used America as a model for its own eugenic sterilization program. The Supreme Court's ruling influenced Germany's genetic health courts, which ordered some 375,000 eugenic sterilizations. In fact, at the Nuremberg trials at the end of World War II, Nazis responsible for sterilizations cited Buck versus Bell in their defense. And that's actually a scene in the classic movie Judgment at Nuremberg. While many of the court's worst decisions are now central parts of American history, Buck v. Bell is not well remembered today. Even in law school constitutional law classes, it's rarely discussed or only mentioned in passing. The leading American constitutional law treatise, which weighs in at over 1,700 pages, devotes just half a sentence and a footnote to the case. I'd like to talk a little bit about Buck v. Bell, a case that became more interesting the more I learned about it, and then talk a little bit about why it still matters. So the United States in the 1920s was caught up in a mania, the drive to use newly discovered hereditary science to perfect humanity. Modern eugenics, which had emerged in England among followers of Charles Darwin, crossed the Atlantic and became a full-fledged intellectual craze. The United States suddenly had a new enemy, bad germplasm and those who carried it. The unfit, the eugenicists warned, threatened to bring down not only the nation, but the whole human race. America's leading citizens led the charge to save humanity by promoting eugenics. John D. Rockefeller, Alexander Graham Bell, President Theodore Roosevelt. And actually, when I was riding down on the Acela 2 days ago from New York, I happened to be seated right across from the great historian Richard Reeves, who's written a lot of presidential histories. And he told me that FDR was actually a big eugenicist as well, something he learned when he was writing about the Japanese internment. Prominent scientists formed pro-eugenic organizations with names like the Committee to Study and to Report on the Best Practical Means of Cutting Off the defective germplasm in the American population. In big cities and small towns, eugenics was the intellectual issue of the day. Women's clubs invited lecturers to speak about arranging eugenic marriages. Clergymen competed in national eugenics sermon contests organized on topics like religion and eugenics. Does the church have any responsibility for improving the human stock? Best-selling books and magazines explained the concept of race betterment to the public. The inspiring, the wonderful message of the new heredity, Cosmopolitan magazine explained, was that it offered the promise of preventing once and for all the birth of the quote, diseased or crippled or depraved. Conferences were held. The American Museum of Natural History in New York hosted the second International Eugenics Congress, a truly terrible gathering, and the U.S. State Department sent out the invitations. Universities taught eugenics. Over 300 universities, including some of our leading ones, Harvard, Columbia, Berkeley, Cornell, and here within Virginia, the University of Virginia was a brain trust of eugenics. The driving force behind the eugenics movement in the 1920s was, historians suggest, the collective fears of the Anglo-Saxon upper and middle classes about a changing America. Record levels of immigration were transforming the nation's ethnic and religious makeup, and with the increased industrialization and urbanization, community and family ties were fraying. These anxieties were being redirected and expressed in the form of fears about the unfit. The eugenics movement offered two solutions, one for the threat from without the country and one for the danger from within. Its answer to the foreign threat was new immigration laws to limit the number of Italians, Eastern European Jews, Asians, and other non-Northern Europeans admitted to the country. The eugenicists claimed that these groups had inordinately high levels of physical and mental hereditary defects that were degrading America's gene pool. Among other things, they claimed, based on their intelligence testing, that between 40 and 50% of Jewish immigrants arriving at Ellis Island were mentally defective. Yeah, amazing. Congress held hearings at which eugenicists explained various nationalities' biological deficiencies. Acting on these eugenic arguments, Congress adopted the Immigration Act of 1924, which invited in more immigrants from Northern Europe and closed the door to Southern and Eastern Europeans. The harm this immigration law did was immense, most of all because of its timing to Jews in Eastern Europe who would soon be trying to flee Nazi Germany's genocidal regime and then would find the door was shut to them. We now know that in the 1940s, Otto Frank wrote repeatedly and desperately for visas for his wife and his daughters, Margot and Anne, but was turned down because of the 1924 Act. So when we think about Anne Frank, it's true that she died in a concentration camp because the Nazis thought Jews were racially inferior, but she also died there because the U.S. Congress believed that to some extent. In addition to immigration limits, to deal with the external threat, the eugenicists worked to address this internal threat through a series of laws designed to prevent the, quote, unfit from reproducing. They began in Connecticut in 1895 with laws prohibiting various kinds of people deemed to be hereditarily unworthy from marrying. But the eugenicists worried that even with these laws, the unfit would just reproduce out of wedlock. So next, they promoted segregation, placing so-called defective people in state institutions during their reproductive years to prevent them from passing on their genes to a new generation. But the problem with that was that holding that many people in institutions was too expensive. Finally, the eugenicists turned to sterilization, which was completely effective and could be carried out on a mass scale relatively inexpensively. Starting with Indiana in 1907, states adopted legislation authorizing forced sterilizations of people judged to have hereditary defects. They called for sterilizing anyone with, quote, defective traits such as epilepsy, criminality, alcoholism, and even dependency, which was just another word for poverty. The eugenicists believed that was a genetic failing as well. Their greatest target, however, was the feeble-minded, a loose designation that included people who were mentally challenged, women considered to be excessively interested in sex, and various other categories of individuals who offended the middle-class sensibilities of judges and social workers. Fears of the tide of feeble-mindedness, as it was called, rose to panic levels. A leading psychologist published an influential study arguing that feeble-mindedness underlies all of our social problems, including crime, poverty, and prostitution. The eugenic sterilization movement's most prominent leader insisted that to remove the worthless one-tenth of the nation, 15 million people would have to go under the knife. So why Virginia? Virginia was actually not in the vanguard of eugenic sterilization. It was actually late to the game. It waited until 1924 to pass its eugenic sterilization law, 17 years after Indiana. But what put it in the center of the legal battle was that Virginia hospitals decided they did not want to sterilize anyone until their law was tested in the courts, all the way to the Supreme Court. So to accomplish this, they decided to create a legal test case. It was Carrie Buck's misfortune to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. Her story is a sad one and an infuriating one. She was being raised in poverty by a single mother here in Charlottesville and was taken in by a foster family. There was nothing wrong with her physically or mentally, but one summer she was raped by a nephew of the foster mother. When she became pregnant out of wedlock, the family wanted to avoid the scandal, perhaps wanted to cover up the crime of a relative. They decided rather than help her to deal with this pregnancy, put her in a place where she could be given help in that regard, they decided to have her declared epileptic and feeble-minded and shipped off to the state colony for epileptics and feeble-minded outside of Lynchburg. And that was incredibly easy to do back then. She arrived at the colony just when the superintendent was looking for an inmate to put at the center of this legal test case. And Carrie had just the personal attributes that they were looking for, the eugenicist. She had been designated feeble-minded, and as a woman who had given birth out of wedlock at the age of 17, she embodied the eugenic nightmare of the feeble-minded reproducing rapidly and flooding the nation with, quote, defectives. Carrie also had the sort of family the eugenicist wanted. Her mother was also a colony inmate who had been designated feeble-minded, probably falsely as well, and she also had other relatives in the institution. And since she had given birth to a daughter, Vivian, the eugenicist could argue that the baby was also feeble-minded, making three generations of feeble-minded people to establish a hereditary pattern. They did get the baby judged to be feeble-minded, although there was nothing wrong with her, and she was at an age of infancy when she was tested, when it's really ridiculous to think that by examining her they could make such a conclusion. There was more to Carrie's story, but no one was interested in hearing it. She was not, in fact, feeble-minded, despite what the state's unreliable intelligence testing reported. Her school records, which the colony was not interested in, revealed her to be of perfectly normal intelligence. And she was not epileptic. She had never had a seizure, and throughout her life never did have a seizure. The colony held a hearing on whether Carrie should be sterilized, a proceeding heavily stacked against her, and ruled that she should be. And it was that order that was appealed through the Virginia courts and up to the U.S. Supreme Court. So nations rely on civil society, public and private institutions devoted to higher values, to promote truth and justice and to make sure that we as a nation are on the right path. Four of the nation's most respected professions were involved in Carrie Buck's story: medicine, academia, law, and the judiciary, in the form of four powerful men. Each of these men was on the wrong side of this case. So Dr. Albert Priddy was the man who selected Carrie to be the first person operated on under the Virginia law. He was a physician. He served as superintendent of the colony for epileptics and feeble-minded. He had also been one of the main people who lobbied the Virginia legislature to pass the eugenic sterilization law. In his campaign for eugenic sterilization, Dr. Priddy had much of the medical profession behind him. Across the country, doctors took a leading role in promoting eugenics and eugenic sterilization. Medical journals were full of polemical articles advocating sterilization with titles like Race Suicide for Social Parasites. Harry Laughlin, the head of the Eugenics Record Office, was the scientist in the story. He gave his expert opinion that the Virginia law should be upheld and that Carrie should be sterilized. He was the most prominent advocate for eugenic sterilization in the nation, and he had drafted a model law that states were using to draw up their own laws. His model law was the basis for the Virginia law. Laughlin, who had a doctorate in biology from Princeton and had been a professor, was also to a great extent representative of his academic peers. Many of the nation's most prominent academic scientists strongly supported eugenics and eugenic sterilization. Aubrey Strode was the lawyer who drafted the Virginia sterilization law, and he went on to defend it in the courts all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. He was also a legislator, represented Amherst County in the legislature. His profession, lawyers, also offered strong support for eugenics. Among the influential voices praising Connecticut's first-in-the-nation eugenics law was the president of the American Bar Association, the most prominent lawyer in America, who declared eugenic marriage laws necessary to protect future generations from the evil operation of the laws of heredity. Finally, it was the great Oliver Wendell Holmes who had the last word on Carrie's fate and who, with his broadside against society's imbeciles, lent his enormous intellectual prestige to the sterilization cause. Holmes was not a man who easily found enjoyment, but he would later say that upholding Virginia's sterilization law and Carrie's sterilization had given him real pleasure. Of all the professions, it was the judiciary's role that was the most disappointing. It's worth noting that the Supreme Court that heard Carrie Buck's case had some of the leading lights of American law on it. The Chief Justice at that time was William Howard Taft, who had already served as president. It included Louis Brandeis, the great progressive, who was known as the people's attorney before joining the court. And, of course, there was Oliver Wendell Holmes, former Harvard Law professor and perhaps the most respected justice in Supreme Court history. When the case reached these nine great men, they got the facts wrong and the legal reasoning they applied was shoddy. The court could have found a variety of legal problems with Carrie's sterilization. It could have found that it violated her constitutional rights, her liberty interest in not being forcibly operated on and sterilized, her due process rights to having a real chance to challenge the sterilization, or her equal protection rights. Or it could have noted that the law required that sterilization be in Carrie's interest. That was in the Virginia law. And being operated on and made sterile was not in her interest. But the court, with very little analysis, simply upheld the Virginia law and allowed Virginia to sterilize Carrie and urged the nation to do more. So those who airbrush Buck v. Bell from history would likely offer a simple explanation, that it is an anomaly, that the Supreme Court, they would argue, was briefly caught up in eugenics, but it was short-lived, a one-time mistake, and that the issues it raises are ones the nation long ago put behind it. But this argument has serious flaws. First, unlike so many of the court's worst rulings, Buck v. Bell has never been overruled. In a 1942 case, the court struck down an Oklahoma law providing for sterilization of certain criminals, but it did so because of its objection to the definition of which crimes would lead to sterilization. The court expressly chose not to overturn or even limit Buck v. Bell, and after the ruling, states continued to sterilize many thousands of people. As recently as 2001, a U.S. Court of Appeals in Missouri, just one step below the Supreme Court cited Buck versus Bell in ruling on the case of a mildly retarded woman ordered by the state to be sterilized. Secondly, there's nothing outdated about the case's subject matter. As recently as 1983, Oregon's Board of Eugenics was still functioning, and it performed its last eugenic sterilization in 1981. In 2014, investigative reporters discovered that 150 female prisoners in California had been sterilized from 2006 to 2010, not always with the woman's consent. And other examples of eugenic sterilization done unofficially emerge with disturbing regularity. More broadly, the 21st century is being hailed as the century of biology, an era that experts say will be defined by the new biology of genomic research, including a vastly deeper understanding of the genetic blueprint for individual humans. Scientists are now able to edit human embryos, paving the way for what the press has dubbed designer babies. This will make it far easier for the state to impose eugenics if it chooses. A final reason Buck v. Bell remains critically important is that its deepest subject is a timeless one: power, and how those who have it use it against those who do not. Carrie was at the bottom of the nation's economic and social hierarchies. In her plea to the court, she was asking for protection from powerful people and institutions that threatened to do her harm. Throughout the history of American law, that has not been a good position to be in. The Code of Hammurabi, the ancient Babylonian law that French archaeologists uncovered in 1902, included 282 distinct laws covering such modern-seeming doctrines as liability for negligent acts and the presumption of innocence. The Code of Hammurabi also had an eloquent statement of its own purpose, quote, to bring about the rule of righteousness in the land so that the strong shall not harm the weak. That simple ideal, more than 3,500 years later, remains the law's highest calling, but it is a vision that the American legal system all too often fails to live up to. Dred Scott, Homer Plessy, Fred Korematsu, they were all weaker parties unjustly being harmed by stronger ones who came to the Supreme Court seeking justice. In each case, the court sided with the strong. In fact, the law's tendency to favor the powerful could be said to be one of its defining features. In the end, this is the most troubling thing about Buck versus Bell. It presented the court with a stark choice between Hammurabi's ideal and its precise opposite. The ancient principle of justice teaches that the purpose of law is to ensure that the strong do not harm the weak. The eugenicists and the state of Virginia insisted that the strong must harm the weak and that it was the law's duty to help. Faced with this decision, the Supreme Court did not merely side with the strong. It enthusiastically urged them on. It insisted it would be better for all the world if society's strongest members simply finished people like Carrie off once and for all. Even the ancient Babylonians understood that helping the strong to obliterate the weak is the very opposite of justice.
Thank you. So one of the things that stood out for me in your book, and I say this as someone who's done a fair amount of reading on this, is how popular and mainstream eugenics was in the 1920s, and how there really weren't large, influential institutions who are against eugenics. When you were mentioning the members of the Supreme Court, when they heard Buck v. Bell. You mentioned Justice Brandeis and described him as the great progressive and the people's attorney. But in the 1920s, at the height of the progressive movement, progressives largely signed on to the ideas behind eugenics. The ACLU, which was at that time fairly new, generally supported eugenic science. How does that popularity kind of change the way we sort of look back on these people who failed so spectacularly, as you say?
Yeah, I mean, your premise is exactly right. It's shocking the degree to which all the people we would think would get these things right, would have the wisdom and the judgment, got this one wrong. And I recently wrote for my alumni magazine, for Harvard Magazine, an article about Harvard's role in the eugenics movement. And I was shocked by what I found. People who have very big buildings named after them on campus, President Lowell, President Eliot, were big eugenicists. President Eliot, who's a revered figure at Harvard, he spoke to the Harvard alumni of San Francisco in 1912 about the importance of racial purity, and he advocated eugenic sterilization, and he was a vice chairman of the first International Eugenics Congress. So all these important people were, as you say, absolutely behind it. So how do we explain that, I think, is difficult to answer. But one thing that I think does come out of this is some of my friends who've read the book have said that when we look at how all of society got this so wrong and how there were so many victims like Carrie Buck and even Anne Frank, maybe what we should be thinking about now is, what are we getting wrong right now? There's something that we all agree is fine that generations later people are going to say, I cannot believe in 2016 everyone thought that was okay. Now, based on what your own personal principles are, your politics, your ethics, you might reach a different conclusion, but I think we should all be thinking hard about that. What are we assuming is right that's wrong?
You mentioned UVA as being eugenics brain trust. In 1924, the dean of the university, which is a position that doesn't exist anymore, but was a very high-level position here, was a biologist, a scientist named Ivy Foreman Lewis. And there are buildings named after Dean Lewis still. And in 1924, he gave a speech on campus that was reported on the New York Times. And one of the things that he said was that one of the great truths that biology has handed down over the generations is eugenics and the way in which we can use eugenics to make a purer population. And he also said that the idea of the great American melting pot, into which one can put the refuse of three continents and draw out good, sound American citizens, is simply and perilously false. This is one of the most important figures at the university. What I want to ask you is about the connection between race and eugenics. It was a connection implied in what Professor Lewis was saying. But in 1924, that's when Virginia passed its sterilization law. 1924 was also a year in which the Congress passed an immigration law. That was, again, what Professor Lewis, Dean Lewis, was referencing. And 1924 was also the year that Virginia passed its Act to Preserve Racial Integrity, which was all about defining whiteness so as not to allow white people to marry non-white people, and so preserve the race. It seems that eugenics, immigration, racial laws are all tied together, but in a way that can be a little confusing.
Yeah, no, I think that's a really great point, and they are. And in fact, the Racial Integrity Act in Virginia was passed the same day as the sterilization law, and there's a strong connection between it because the eugenicists of that time and that place, their view was eugenics could be used to, as they like to say, uplift the race. The race they meant was the white race. That was the race they thought was worth saving. These folks thought that the black race was already so deficient that there really wasn't much point in wasting eugenic effort on it. So the two things they did were to try to build a strong wall between blacks and whites so there wasn't racial mixing there, and then begin focusing on people like Carrie Buck and her mother Emma Buck, people from the lower white classes, in quotation marks, poor whites who they thought were bringing down the white race. So there's that focus. And then, as you say, the Immigration Act was focused on keeping out all the Italians and Jews and Asians who might, again, infect the white race. That changed changes over time. And in the 70s, in places like North Carolina, many of the eugenic sterilizations were of African Americans, and that's true in Virginia as well. But at that early moment in the 20s, it was really about how can we make a great white race.
One of the things that was obviously maybe seductive about eugenics for a lot of people in the 1920s was the scientific veneer of this movement. People could argue with a straight face that it's not me saying that we should do this, it's science saying that we should do this. But one of the things that strikes me about the Carrie Buck case is the way in which science seems to be disregarded throughout the process. There's one moment where there's a hearing that's initially held at the state institution where she's being held to determine that she ought to be sterilized. And I believe that in that hearing, they called as witnesses a nurse, three teachers, an orphanage superintendent, a welfare office clerk, and a man who claimed to be the brother-in-law of her father, whom I don't believe she'd ever met. Only two of those people even knew her, and only one of them had interacted with her recently. But that was the scientific slash legal basis of deciding on her sterilization. So it seems to me curious that there was such a disregard for the science at such a critical moment in a movement that was founded on science.
I think it's a great point. There was the veneer of science, as you say. They wanted the intellectual credentials of the scientists and of scientific theory, but there was not actual concern about the facts. So if you wanted to find out if Carrie Buck was feeble-minded, you might want to find out what her grades were. And as I said, her grades were fine. You might want to talk to her teachers. No one wanted to talk to her teachers. If you wanted to rule about whether or not she was epileptic, you might want someone to say that they had once seen her have a seizure, but no one testified to that either. So they really didn't care. And Carrie Buck was someone who, if anyone really encountered her and experienced her, if they had let her testify at the trial, there was nothing wrong with her. And, you know, one of the many tragedies of this is late in life when she's an old woman and very much regrets not having been able to have other children, everyone who knew her said there was nothing wrong with her mentally. She was perfectly fine. And friends of hers at a retirement home said two things about her. One, that she waited for the newspaper to come every morning. She loved keeping up on the news. And one of her friends, and she did the crossword puzzle together every day. There was nothing wrong with this woman, but they didn't care about that. It wasn't about that.
Hmm. Are there questions in the audience?
I heard your interview on NPR, and it was wonderful.
Thank you very much.
I've heard say that also. You opened your comments saying that there is a long list of nominations for the worst Supreme Court decisions, and then you went on to talk about Strong versus Weak and what are we getting wrong now. I just think it's worth noting that the Charlottesville Council, where we're meeting, proclaimed that it would be Citizens United.
Yes.
And today the president did finally make a nomination, so it'll be interesting to see what we continue to get wrong or if we write that wrong. But my question for you, sir, is I've already started reading your book as a result of hearing it, but I got my copy at the library. And sometimes I've asked this question at book fairs before, and it's almost like a social faux pas to bring it up. But I'm curious your feeling about or thoughts on sales of your book to the library. I know you'd love it if we'd all buy your book, and I probably will. But how do you feel about books in the library?
I'm a huge believer in libraries. I love libraries, and I'm very fortunate. I live in New York, where we have an amazing public library, and our library is so great that one thing we have, I was just using it this morning as I drove over here, is we have an app that you can put on your iPhone that allows you to download a free audiobook instantaneously. So when I have a long drive, as I did today from Washington, D.C., I go to my phone, I go to the New York Public Library app, I download an audiobook, I get to listen to it while I drive. I love this. You know, know, for, you know, authors do have sort of, I think, two interests. One is there is an economic component, absolutely. And I think that's not just a selfish thing on the part of authors. I think that we as a society want to make sure that authors can support themselves so that we, you know, are able to get more books. And I feel like I'm doing fine. I'm going to write another book. I'll be fine. But I do worry about the younger generation of authors and their ability to write books. So for that reason, we do want there to be a market for books. But the other thing every author wants is to be read, is to engage an audience, to have their ideas out there. So, you know, I'm delighted if you read it from the library. I'm thrilled that you listen to, you know, my discussion of the book on NPR. And, you know, I think this is all sort of part of the mix. But as a journalist, I can tell you that the issue about how people who produce ideas and words will get paid is a huge, huge issue, not just for those individuals, but for society, right? Because we need some way to pay the people who are going to cover the Charlottesville City Council and make sure that things are done correctly. And if newspaper subscribers are not going to do that, who is? So this is part of a large, large issue about how are we going to continue to have a robust marketplace of books and journalism and ideas. But I think the short answer, as I said, is, you know, it's nice when people buy it, certainly. But anyone who takes the time to read an author's words, I think the author is very grateful for that.
Yes. Hello. I'm a retired librarian.
Oh.
I live in Stanton. I volunteer at the archives in the Augusta County Historical Society, which was given a fairly large trunk full of personal papers that were left in the last home that Dr. Joseph DeJarnett lived in wow. Stanton. And so I had the privilege of organizing these papers. When I told people what I was doing and told them something about DeJarnett, to my dismay, several people would say to me, oh, maybe that's not such a bad idea. And then they would invariably give me some example of someone they knew who was mentally challenged, who had several children, or a homeless person who had several children, or I would like to know, what would you respond to those people? And my second part of my question is, we have some people running for office today who are very authoritarian, and I did buy your book.
Thank you.
And
a librarian bought it. That's beautiful.
I support independent bookstores. And some of the things they are saying, especially about the poor and about immigrants, are scarily the same as similar to what Lachlan and the other people were saying. And so how concerned are you about this?
So you've packed so many great questions in there. I'm not sure I'm going to do them all justice, but let me just throw out a few ideas. One is I'm not surprised that you heard that from a lot of people. You know, one thing that the internet has given us among the many gifts is the internet reader comment. So we now have these comment sections where you actually get a sense of what people really think rather than what they say, you know, to your face or to other people's faces. And, you know, I've been reading a lot of these comments about eugenics as things, there have been articles about things that I've done with this book. It's shocking how much support there is in the internet comment discussions about, yes, we, you know, we could use some of this for, often for the political party that I don't agree with, but often for, you know, the sort of folks you're talking about. I would draw a distinction when we talk about, I think there are complicated issues involving how, you know, who is fit to be a parent. And, you know, you do at a certain point worry, you know, you want to make sure that a child is raised properly. I'm not saying that there's no point at which the state might not want to get involved. If there's someone who's truly incapable, say, of feeding a child, you might be concerned about that. But eugenics really wasn't about that, right? Eugenics was about saying that certain people, their genes were bad. And that's almost always a terrible idea. As for our current times, you know, a lot of people see the 20s as being a distant mirror for today, right? And when I mentioned that people felt that what was driving eugenics in the 20s was insecurity, right, that our nation was changing, that immigrants were coming in large numbers, you can see that a lot of that is going on today as well, a lot of the same fears. And it's not being expressed right now in eugenics necessarily, although it could soon, but we're seeing it in the immigration debate, right? So I think that, you know, we have this idea of the 20s, I think, from the movies as being about flappers and prohibition and parties and all that. It was actually a very troubled time, and troubled in a lot of the same ways that America is in 2016. So I think there's a lot, you know, to learn from reading that history.
said that the decision was 8-1. Which justice was against it, and what did he say in his dissent?
Great question, and it gives me an opportunity to do a little shout out to one of the few heroic groups in the story. So the one justice who dissented, Pierce Butler, was the only Catholic on the court and probably the most conservative member of the court. He did not write an opinion, so we don't know what he was thinking. People do think it was probably related to his Catholicism because he was fairly observant and seemed to be influenced by Catholic views and other things he did. The Catholics were largely the heroes of this story, and that's for a couple of reasons. One is, in general, there was concern about interfering with the reproductive cycle, just like in the abortion debate, but also a lot of Catholics believe that people should be judged on their spiritual qualities, not on these physical qualities that the eugenicists were so focused on. So for those two reasons, and maybe others, Catholics were among the most outspoken opponents of eugenics at a time when very few people spoke out. So when there was legislation proposed for eugenic sterilization, some of the groups you might think would be there doing the right thing, say the League of Women Voters. The League of Women Voters was in New Jersey. They were in favor of eugenic sterilization. But it was the nuns and the priests and the Catholic lay people who showed up. And in states like Louisiana, which had a large Catholic population, it was because of that Catholic opposition that eugenic sterilization bills got voted down. So this is an era when actually a lot of conservatives like to look at this era and say it was largely progressives who got it wrong. And I would add that there were a lot of conservatives and even racists who supported eugenics. But they do say that it was people like Justice Butler, like the Catholic Church, who were the most right. And I think there's a fair amount of truth to that.
Who was the legal team, or was there a legal team defending?
That's a great question, and another sad part of the case. So under the law, Carrie Buck was entitled to a lawyer after the sterilization hearing to go into the courts. So they gave her a lawyer. They gave her a lawyer who had been the chairman of the colony's board of directors, who was a friend of theirs, who, it seems very clear, wanted to see her sterilized. So this guy, Irving Whitehead, to read his briefs is really very discouraging because there were pairs of briefs, and the brief on behalf of the colony written by Aubrey Strode, who was a very fine lawyer, were very long and very detailed and cited many good cases. Carrie's lawyer didn't cite the most important cases, and you read it and you find he's making an argument that actually seems to support sterilization. Wow, he talks about how throughout human history, even in ancient times, Plato and all that, eugenics was an important value. Like, okay, I'm not sure that's going to help her. And then at the trial, what was really tragic is Aubrey Strode brought in really powerful expert testimony from people like Harry Laughlin, this academic expert from the Eugenics Record Office. There were no expert witnesses on Carrie Buck's side, even though there were scientists who could have said that eugenic science was wrong at that point. And also, he didn't bring in any of this factual evidence we talked about. He could have introduced her grades to show she was getting good grades. Are these the grades of a feeble-minded person? He could have brought in her teachers. He could have brought in people to say that she had never had a seizure. So that was her legal team. And it's sad because really at no juncture was anyone really fighting for Carrie. And she was too uneducated, having been pulled out of school after fifth grade, to do it for herself. So compounding the sadness of the story.
Hi. I remember reading, correct me if I'm wrong, that the Stanford-Binet IQ test comes out in that time period or a little before that. And I'm interested in what other, quote, scientific sort was in the air. And if you talked about that, I apologize because I came late. But I do remember that, well, not personally remember, but I do remember reading about that, in history, and that was part of what was kind of in the air, the development, how you could use science to measure people and what they did and other things. So if there are some other examples, I'd appreciate it.
Sure. I actually think you put your finger on the most important one. This was a moment when intelligence testing was really coming into its own. It had been designed originally in France, and the original conception of it was it would identify students who needed a little bit more help, but the founders there said it should not be used to create categories. So, of course, it comes to America, and what do? We immediately use it to create categories, including the imbeciles of the title. You know, there were actually three scientific categories that were created by Dr. Goddard. The idiots were at the bottom, the imbeciles were at the middle, and then the morons were at the top. And a slightly pedantic point, but in addition to everything else horrible about this decision, Carrie Buck and her mother, when they went to the colony, were actually tested and rated as morons, which was actually the highest class of defective person. So Oliver Wendell Holmes, in addition to everything else he did, demoted them by one class by calling them imbeciles. The testing was incredibly crude, and it wasn't really anything that would produce accurate results as to who was intelligent or mentally defective. So some of the questions Carrie was asked on her intelligence test were things like, what do you do if a playmate hits you? Okay, I mean, it's an interesting question, but I'm not sure that based on that answer, you can really tell if someone is an imbecile or a moron. And, you know, same thing with the testing done. You know, I mentioned that 40 to 50% of the Jewish immigrants arriving at Ellis Island were judged to be feeble-minded. Well, you know, it didn't take into account the fact that these are people getting off a boat who maybe had no idea what a test was, right? I mean, they're coming from some rural place and someone's rapidly asking them questions. Well, you know, so that was not taken into account, or the fact that maybe they hadn't slept for 2 weeks, traveling in steerage. So these were not scientific tests, but we as Americans did what the French didn't do, which is we took them and used them to create very rigid categories and, in fact, to sterilize people as a result. So I think that whole intelligence testing movement, which was starting, was really the most lethal part of the science going on then.
Two questions. One is, what was her life between being sterilized and much later being in the retirement home, apparently living a normal life in the retirement home? And the other question is, did she ever go to court for any kind of compensation, remedy, anything at all? Or was this sad time in the Supreme Court the only time she saw a courtroom?
Great questions. You know, her life was pretty sad afterwards. So she sterilized right after the ruling. And one thing that they said throughout the litigation was one of the great things for Carrie about being sterilized is that she would be released from the colony, which, you know, because she would no longer be a genetic threat. Also, they kept representing, and this is in the legal briefs, that the Dobbs family, that's the family that had been her foster family, they had taken in her daughter Vivian when she was sent off to the colony. They were raising Vivian as their own child, but that she could then go live with the Dobbs family and then be with her daughter. So, okay, she would be sterilized, but she had this opportunity to live in the same household with her only child. So that was represented to the Supreme Court. So, of course, as soon as she sterilized, when they are going to place her, the Dobbs family said, we don't want her, we will not take her. So she's separated from her daughter, and they placed her in a series of households where she was essentially a domestic worker. She wrote letters to the colony that are in the Library of Virginia, that are really striking because it's more evidence that she wasn't feeble-minded. These are really beautiful letters. In some cases, her letters are actually much more articulate than her employer's letters that they're writing to the colony at the same time. And she expresses concern about how her mother's doing at the colony, and she's sending food for her mother. So she's writing back and forth from her placements. She ends up marrying twice, never having children. But at the end of her life, as I said, she, you know, was judged to be, by everyone who knew her, not feeble-minded. But also, when she was interviewed at the very end, she never went to court. But reporters found her towards the end of her life, and she said she very much had wanted to have children. One other sort of sad footnote to this is she had a sister, Doris, who was at the colony at the same time. And Doris was also one of the first people sterilized in the state of Virginia shortly after Carrie was. Doris, like many people, was not told that she was being sterilized. She just had an operation at the colony. So late in her life, she's wondering, as an older woman, whether she is eligible for Social Security. And she writes to the colony. She asks the colony if they know her age. And the director at the time, who was a much more enlightened sort than Dr. Albert Priddy, goes to see her and informs her she is eligible. She's actually of age to get Social Security. He also tells her that she was sterilized. And she and her husband begin to cry because they had been trying their whole lives to have children, and they didn't know that she had been sterilized. And she had a scar on her, and the doctor asked what it was, and she said that they said something about her getting an appendectomy or something. So Doris has a very sad end of her life where she learns very late in life what had been done to her. So these are terrible stories. None of them were compensated. You know, we're getting some compensation now in the state, but as, you know, Doris and Carrie's story suggests, much too late for many of the people who were harmed.
There was a federal court case in 1981 in which the federal court ruled that the sterilizations had been legal. The United States Supreme Court had said so, and that there was no cause to believe that that the law had been broken in any other way as to the procedure. But it required that the state search out any living people who had been sterilized and inform them that they'd been sterilized, since, as you say, that wasn't always the case, and then to inform them of the consequences of the operation, to provide them with counseling and medical treatment. But I'm not sure that there was any, you know, monetary payout.
So thank you for being here, and I was a few minutes late, so if you addressed at the beginning, I'm sorry. But one of the distinctions that gets made in contemporary discourse is between negative and positive eugenics, and the idea is that the 20s were sort of comprehensively sterilization was the technology available. It was all about negation, and now we're engaged in a different type of enterprise that may be eugenic in tone, but is not about negative eugenics. We're interested in enhancement and something else. And that, I'm wondering if that distinction feels imposed on the time period, like if that feels natural to the period. Did people talk about it in those sorts of terms? And whether that distinction matters at all for your analysis of eugenics as such.
Okay, great question. So when eugenics was originally invented by Francis Galton, the half-cousin of Charles Darwin, he had this idea of negative and positive eugenics, and he was actually more of a positive eugenics sort. So in his mind, positive eugenics was finding the really fit people, the people who we want to reproduce, and encouraging them to have more children. That, you know, feels a little, you know, at least a little more palatable than the preventing people from having children, which is the negative side. When it came to America, as you suggest, it became much more about the negative part. Now we have a whole new kind of positive and negative eugenics going on in the 21st century, I would suggest, which is, as I mentioned, we now have the ability to edit the human genome, the human embryo. We're very early in this. The Chinese just did it last year. But the idea is that we may, over time, be able to create, as the media call it, designer babies. We may be able to edit out certain genes and change things in a way that will not only affect that baby, but every baby that descends from that baby. So how could this be positive eugenics? Well, so one interesting thing is right now there's an international debate going on about whether this should be allowed. Is this something that is too Frankenstein-like? Are we messing around with life? And are we going to change the human race forever? There are people who say we should go, you know, be very cautious about it. Some of the biggest supporters of this kind of designer baby technology are actually people who have serious genetic diseases. So there's a scientist who has Huntington's disease, a very terrible genetic disease that, you know, his mother went mad and died young. He has those genes, and he would be passing them on to his children. He says, of course we need to have, you know, editing of the human embryo if we can do it, because if I could possibly not pass this terrible gene on to my my children, I'd like to avoid that. So that in some ways is, I think, truly possibly a positive form of eugenics. And, you know, by the test of, like, the way I set it up in my book, you know, are we helping the weak or hurting them? The eugenics of Buck versus Bell was hurting weak people like Carrie Buck. We could possibly have a form of editing of human embryos that allows the weak, people who have these, you know, very serious genetic defects, to then have children that don't, that might be helping the weak. So maybe that's a good form of eugenics. But it's a complicated area, and there's going to be a lot of discussion about it.
I'm interested in Native Americans, and Dr. Walter Pucker was in charge of the Virginia Bureau for Vital Statistics, and he held that position from 1912 to 1946. The Racial Integration Act, which was 1924 to 1967, when a Native American was born, they either said the baby was black or white, and it was their way of eliminating the eight Native Americans that are in the tribes that are in the state of Virginia. Now they're 11 because they got a different way but it's this 1920s again, and you know it doesn't just stop with sterilization. And I didn't realize that because I moved here from Michigan. But this is, they were eliminating the Native Americans. Either the baby is a black or he's white.
I'm so glad you mentioned this because when I was on the radio the other day, someone called in and said that she knew a Native American woman who had been sterilized and was trying to work on telling her story. And then I was at a book event in Washington, D.C. the other night, and she came to that and started telling me more about it. I believe there probably is a great untold story about how this was used against Native Americans, how eugenics was used against them. And what I said to that woman was, please keep researching. We need to know a lot more about it. So I'm glad you raised it. I think, you know, it's probably a hidden history that we need to know more about.
I think, though, you're dealing... we have friends in our class in high school who were brilliant, a girl that's brilliant. And her mother died, had Alzheimer's at age 50. And that was her great fear, age 50. And she now does have Alzheimer's. She doesn't even know her husband. And her sister also is diagnosed with Alzheimer's. And when you're dealing with the hereditary genes, I think you've got almost an infantile way of talking about it. You know, it's something that we really can't get into very much.
These are hard questions, very, very hard.
Well, one of the things that's at the root of what you're talking about with Walter Plecker and eugenics is just the desire of the people who ran things in Virginia and elsewhere to keep the white race pure. If they could do that through eugenics, then they did that. The way that Walter Plecker did it was not by sterilizing people, but by enforcing Virginia law, which required that everyone who was born or got married register their race with the state. And so Walter Plecker was in the unique position to decide for you what race you were. And he could decide that there were no such things as Virginia Indians anymore. There had once been, but there weren't anymore. They had intermarried with African Americans to the point to where they didn't exist anymore to Walter Plecker. And so he could eliminate an entire race of people, at least bureaucratically, just with the pen. He didn't need the surgeon's knife. But the motivations behind it were the same.
But the law never was changed until 1960.
That's right. Loving v. Virginia. Yep.
One of the more curious manifestations of this positive eugenics was, of course, William F. Shockley, co-discoverer of the transistor with two others, and who tried to start his own sperm bank. And his notion was that only Nobel Prize-winning sperm could be assured to be intellectual enough. I'm not don't remember what he did for women because there weren't many Nobel Prize winners. But Shockley apparently didn't know anything about regression to the mean. And you were wondering whether we are not maybe doing things today that later on we'll look back on. And you mentioned designer babies. And I think we have to give that. That is an example of positive eugenics. And there's no force, but we really need to think about that deeply.
Great point.
Hi, thank you. I was curious about what's the genesis of your passion to write and research all this? What got you started on this?
Sure. I'm sorry. Sure. So when I was in law school, as I think I mentioned, I we didn't learn this in con law, but we did know this phrase, three generations of imbeciles are enough. And, you know, we were young. We kind of joked about it a bit. But we thought it was odd that Oliver Wendell Holmes, who went to Harvard Law School, he's like on every hallway. There's a portrait of him. He's revered. And this was sort of always an oddity. We didn't quite understand why he would have said this. So at a certain point, when I was thinking about the next book I wanted to write, I wanted to write about the Supreme Court, but I was also thinking that, you know, you can learn a certain amount from an institution by studying the best things it's done, but you can really learn, I think, often more by looking at the worst things it's done. And this had been in my mind for a long time. And when I started looking into it, the story was so rich, and then, you know, your publisher wants you to make sure that there haven't been, you know, other big books that have, you know, already made the story, like, you know, well-known to a large audience. There hadn't been. And the more I looked into it, the richer the story was. So it kind of grabbed me. But you know, ultimately, I think when I write books, they're very often the theme is about, are we building a just society? How do you build a just society? How do we treat, you know, the weakest among us? And this was such an example of that, that the highest court in the land, the people that in our society we really count on to step in at the last minute, make sure that the people whose rights should be protected are protected. They got it so wrong. So I thought that was a story that I would like to tell.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah.
How old is the term white as a racial category? And then number two, did you speak at all how this then feeds into Hitler's vision?
Yes. And I can say a couple more words about that. I'm not actually an historian of the use of the word white, but there's a whole, you know, there was a couple decades ago the start of a whiteness studies movement in academia. There are people who really are experts on the notion of whiteness. I'm afraid I'm not one of them, but I encourage you to seek out their work. But on the Nazism, I did talk about it a little bit, but I would say I'm glad you mentioned that. You know, one thing that also was striking, you know, I was struck by so many horrible things about the story, but you know, we forget the degree to which there were close ties between American academics and American thought leaders and Nazis. So Harry Laughlin, one of the villains of my book, he's the guy who gives the expert testimony that Carrie Buck is feeble-minded, who wrote the model eugenics law. He was in close touch with the Nazis. He corresponded with them regularly, and he wrote with pride in his eugenic journal, which he edited, that the Nazis were modeling their eugenic laws on our eugenic laws. In 1936, the University of Heidelberg bestowed an honorary doctorate on him. A lot of people thought he shouldn't accept it. It was a year after they had purged all the Jews from their faculty. He happily accepted it. And his wife, Pansy, who lived with him on Long Island when he was running this eugenics center, she used to participate in community theater. And she wrote a little comic play about eugenics, which had all these young people figuring out who they should marry. And one of the lessons of the play was that the Jewish peddler was not an appropriate eugenic choice for any of them. So the degree to which these folks were friends with Nazis and thought like Nazis in the 20s and 30s was really, you know, chilling.
So let me take the privilege of the last question, because sure. I wanted to follow up on that. In the vein of those who don't learn from history, you're doomed to repeat it. At the end of World War II, when all of the horrors of the Nazi regime came out, was the connection back to the eugenics movement here made, and what was the general reaction of the public if this was known?
Great question. So I think there's sort of two answers to that. One is that the rise of Nazism did actually have a clear impact on the eugenics movement in the United States. It actually was, I think, the reason that it became a lot less popular. So this eugenics record office on Long Island that Harry Laughlin ran was actually funded by the Carnegie Institution and well-funded. With the rise of the Nazis, everyone became much more uncomfortable about it. So one of the, you know, more positive developments in my story is that actually December 31st, 1939, the Eugenics Record Office shuts down because it loses its funding, because all of these people that had happily been funding it for a long, long time decided it just felt too much like the Nazis. So Harry Laughlin ends up losing his job, having to go back to Missouri. So Nazism really had an impact on the eugenics movement. But the flip side of that is, even despite it all, we continued to do eugenic sterilizations. So there were many in the 40s and 50s and here in Virginia until 1979. So it had an impact, but it didn't really teach us the lesson we needed to learn.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.